This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. Coming up on the podcast, Manumita Murgia, the writer whose work focuses on technology and society, is here to discuss her book, Code Dependent, a study of how technology and AI, designed with idealistic intent, is creeping into our everyday infrastructure to have a significant effect on our lives, and not always for the better. Manumita is AI editor for the FT, and joining her in conversation for this episode is Carl Miller, co-founder of the Center for the Analysis of Social Media at the think tank Demos, and author of The Death of the Gods, The New Global Power Grab. Here's Carl with more.
Madhu, very warm welcome to you.
Hi, lovely to be here.
So the premise of the book, what made you really want to focus on the kind of human consequences, I suppose, of AI?
So I've spent over a decade at this point writing about AI, which feels mad because I think my entire working career has been 11 years. So, but basically, from very early on at Wired, I was fascinated by these technologies. And back then, it was very much sort of sci-fi-ish, you know, the future of technology kind of stories on brain-machine interfaces and so on. But over the years, it's evolved into something that's kind of embedded so much into our daily lives. And because I've been writing about it over that period, I kind of felt like the stories I was writing were evolving too, and were going from kind of, oh, look at this amazing, crazy fringe thing to, you know, the DWP is using AI technologies to decide who should get benefits, which is like feels like such a mundane application, right? Or insurance companies are using this to price, what your premiums should be for car insurance. So the whole story changed as the technology evolved. And for me, I found that what I was writing and what I was reading about AI around the world, it often was kind of so focused on the magic of the technology itself, or how it worked, or what it could do, because of the sort of sci-fi aura around it, that we were not noticing how it was transforming our everyday lives in kind of often hidden ways. So when I set out to write it, I wanted to do something that no one else was doing, which was looking at just the lives of ordinary people, not the demigods that we put on pedestals who are building these systems, who are fascinating, of course, you know, the innovators and the entrepreneurs, but really to move out of the bubble of Silicon Valley and look at where it's reached. You know, the far-flung corners unexpectedly, like Argentina or Kenya or rural India, where, you know, people are using these systems or are being subjected to these systems. So I wanted to go and find these stories and kind of tell it in a very human way. Also for audiences who didn't know that they cared about technology or who maybe thought that they don't, but to kind of be like, well, this is a part of everyone's life now. So that was the motivating kind of the impulse that I started out with.
And you paint these like really vivid scenes throughout the book. I mean, pen portraits of characters, like it almost strikes me at times like it's almost like a travel log, Madhu, the way that you bring the kind of the physical place into the book and into the discussion. Was that all deliberate as well? So to kind of really try and introduce the reader to the actual places, be that a barrio in Argentina or a law enforcement context in Amsterdam, where these technologies were actually having impacts.
Yeah. And the reason for that is I feel like often, you know, if you read what's out there about AI, you could be forgiven for thinking this is all just happening either in California or in sort of very developed Western nations. And for me, trying to talk about the impact, you know, on people, I felt like I needed to talk about where they were living, what that looked like, and how their communities and the culture plays into, you know, into how AI is implemented. And I think you can talk a lot about, you know, theoretically about impacts of AI on people or ethical issues around AI, but nothing brings it to life, you know, better than going and meeting somebody and kind of talking to a community about what did this mean for you? How did it change your life? And also, I, you know, to go to places that you wouldn't expect AI to be in. So I wanted to kind of bring that home through my writing.
And we'll meet some of these people in a moment. But overall, it was your sense that as you stepped away from the kind of clinical labs and the venture capital pitches and the ethical frameworks and into these real settings, was your sense that it just all got so much messier? So, you know, as AI kind of tangled with real life, you had unintended consequences, kind of human ambitions, and sometimes, you know, like brazenly authoritarian applications as well. But it all just becomes so much different to what it might look like on paper or might look like indeed in Silicon Valley.
That's exactly it. That's the heart of the whole book, I think, which is that you can, you know, code something on a computer and expect it to behave in a certain way. But partly because of the nature of AI itself, which is that, you know, it's a predictive engine. It's not just pure Q&A, black and white. There are so many gray areas in terms of how they kind of output, whether that's images and words with generative AI or decisions with sort of more statistical AI systems. You know, it's messy. It's not black and white. And in particular, as you say, when it's kind of introduced into a human context where traditionally humans have been in charge or are the experts, you find that, you know, actually unexpected things happen. Even people with good intentions, you know, who implement these systems, it ends up having, you know, really harmful results. So, you know, you mentioned Amsterdam. That for me was a really perfect example of, you know, a city that was hoping to do good. They introduced an AI system to predict future criminals amongst children, you know, which sounds dystopian. But their goal was to find families that needed help, that needed guidance, and to come in early and kind of help these children, mostly boys, to kind of stay on the right track and to support them. But really what ended up happening was it felt like they had a target on their backs. You know, they became much more aware of and entangled with the police system. You know, it was far more punitive and corrective and coercive than kind of protective, which is what was intended. And so I think there are lots of these examples that of the messiness of human nature and human societies that we can't predict until we start rolling AI out, and that we need to be aware of as well.
So just staying with Amsterdam, because that was such a fascinating case study. Was the moral of the story there that prediction can become kind of self-fulfilling? So in the very act of these models being used to shine a spotlight on some people than others, actually made it more likely for them to have more interactions with the police and more kind of experiences with enforcement authorities than other people that hadn't been kind of nominated by the algorithms in the same way.
Exactly that, yeah. So, you know, they were coming up with these lists, and these were lists of mostly boys, majority Moroccan immigrants in Amsterdam. So, you know, in some ways, a very sort of specific type of list of young people. And while, you know, as I said, they were supposed to support these families, many of which, you know, were single parent families, single mother families, really, you know, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy, essentially, where children who maybe were in a little bit of trouble, there was some truancy, maybe had committed some sort of low impact, as they call them, crimes, started to feel like this was their destiny, and they were They were constantly being pulled up by police. They were recognized in public by police who would kind of call out their names. And all of this fed into them feeling like they'd already done something bad. And so they might as well do more of it, you know, which is, if you've ever been a teenager, is kind of feels like the obvious outcome of that. And also in some cases, they became targets for drug gangs and things like that, because they knew that these boys had kind of could get into trouble anyway. And the police were watching them, and they sort of used that to kind of force them into committing crimes that they maybe otherwise wouldn't have. So I think often, you know, trying to prophesy something through a predictive system makes you feel like you have a fixed path. And for something that's so changeable as human behavior, especially like as a child or a young person, you know, we all know how much you can change from between 16 to, you know, 26. It did feel like, you know, very punitive for these children. So that's kind of one of the unintended consequences, I think, of using AI to make what looks like a mathematical prediction about somebody's life.
Whilst we're on the topic of young people's lives, especially being shaped by these predictions, tell us a bit about Argentina and pregnancy predictions and what you saw there.
Yeah, that was, so in some ways related, right? But in such a completely different part of the world. So the system, the algorithm at the heart of that story was one that was attempting to predict teenage pregnancies amongst families. And this was in Salta, which is a small town in the north of Argentina, you know, near the borders of Bolivia. And the system was kind of developed in conjunction with Microsoft by a local bureaucrat who had worked as a data scientist. And he really felt, you know, there was a problem there. You know, there were several, you know, there was rising teenage pregnancies. In many cases, these girls ended up having to, you know, start working at a young age to support their families, and this kind of cycle of poverty perpetuated. So this is a social issue that existed that social workers and others had been trying to address. Often it was found in the barrios amongst, you know, socioeconomically disadvantaged populations, who tended to be from the local indigenous populations rather than the kind of European immigrants. And so there was a lot of kind of ethnic and sociocultural issues associated with these teenage pregnancies also. Also remember, and at the time, until 2020, abortions were illegal in Argentina. It's a very Catholic community as well. So all of this played into the fact that he felt an algorithm to predict these pregnancies would be the best way to tackle them, because then they could, similar to Amsterdam, target resources, public resources, towards these families and help them, you know, to prevent what he saw as this negative outcome, and help these families to get jobs or help these girls to be educated. But having kind of painted a picture for you about the sort of small town, highly Catholic, the socioeconomic divide between indigenous and, you know, non-indigenous populations in Salta, you can see why this could play out to, you know, be really negative, you know, in terms of the consequences. And, you know, what are you going to do? Turn up to a family and say your 14-year-old is going to be pregnant? Like, how are they going to cope with that? So I traveled up there. I met with this former bureaucrat to really understand what his motivations were. How did he expect to roll something like this out? How did he speak to the families? And what I found there was, it wasn't, you know, the sort of dystopian dark outcome that you might expect. You know, he wasn't going around telling people they were going to get pregnant. It was more something much more sort of maybe banal, but equally disappointing, I think, which is that nothing happened for these people. Their lives were not improved in any way. The algorithm was sort of suspended when he left government. Nobody did anything with all the data that was collected. And really the only people who seemed to benefit were Pablo, the bureaucrat, who's now gone on to be a startup founder, selling this idea to other Latin American and African governments as a way to sort of improve socioeconomic conditions, and possibly Microsoft, that, you know, it gave them a bit of a taste of working with public authorities and kind of some experience in that area. So really the people it was meant to benefit never saw any benefits from it, along with the kind of very problematic issues of trying to profile girls who are trying to get pregnant. So I think, you know, again, lots of unintended and social consequences there that could have been, you know, much better anticipated, I think.
I think you're walking through one of those neighborhoods with an activist who says the problems are blindingly obvious.
Yeah.
Like, we need sanitation, we need nutrition, we need education. Like, we don't need an algorithm to pinpoint individuals. In fact, entire neighborhoods are vulnerable, and it's clear why they are.
Exactly. And she was not even an activist. She was literally an older woman who has been living as part of the barrio community for many years, who felt a personal responsibility to kind of to look out for her community. And she walked with me through this neighborhood with one of their local councillors. And it was so clear to her what needed fixing, right? You know, the rains were coming, the roads were in bad condition, young people needed a place to gather. And none of that was being addressed. Instead, you know, politicians are looking for shiny solutions for what you really just need human kind of, you need more social workers, more support. So yeah, I think it was, for me, that was the kind of contrast, where the promise of technology sometimes is just doesn't match up to what you actually need in reality.
In this particular use case, Madhu, where we've got, which I no doubt we'll see more of in the future, you know, the use of these kinds of analytics technologies to profile individual risks in a way to allow more targeted use of public funding. Is there a philosophical objection to this around the way in which it kind of actually removes individual autonomy and choice and kind of turns people into like floating probabilistic clouds of risk?
I think that, yes. So philosophically, I think if you know that you have a sweeping social issue, we should be looking at it from sort of multiple perspectives, you know, whether that's social workers, governments, educators, all coming together to figure out how to fix something rather than just bringing in data scientists, you know, to target individual families. But I think the other issue is also maybe, you know, maybe statistical systems can help under-resourced, say, you know, local councils or other public institutions to figure out how to deploy resources. I can see why that could be attractive. But it's so important to kind of figure out how you include the actual communities there. So in both cases, the biggest issue for the people I spoke to, so in the case of Amsterdam, you know, I spent time speaking with one of the mothers of two boys who were on this list. Her issue was being completely excluded from the discussion, right? She didn't know why her children were on the list. She felt like she was being told it was her fault. That she had this whole host of like lawyers and like other sort of public workers coming in and kind of making her feel like she wasn't up to scratch at her job as a mother, and really cut her out of the whole decision making. And if you're trying to kind of strengthen children's futures, how can you cut their mothers out? And so I think so much of this is we need to figure out if we're going to deploy it in, you know, via government, how do you include the people that it's predicting things about so that they feel that they have a voice and some agency? And actually with Diana, the mother in Amsterdam, you know, when she eventually kind of wrote to the mayor and she got a new, you know, they provided a counselor for her who kind of worked with her rather than against her, she actually found that it was helpful ultimately to be kind of assisted by this counselor from the city to kind of get her family back on track. And she kind of now is of the opinion that it's not all bad, but it's really about, you know, how you frame these things. Is it a target on your back? Have you done something bad that you're meant to be punished for? Or is this genuinely meant to be like a restorative justice thing? In which case, you know, you need to include these voices in, you know, that you're using AI systems on.
Well, some of the first people you write about are the people actually doing the training, the kind of labeling and cleaning of the data. So tell us a bit about this kind of global precariat, I think is how you describe them. And to me, like just the tremendous amount of cognitive elbow grease that actually goes into training them. I mean, it makes me feel that like automation is a bit of a misnomer sometimes as to how these models are actually created.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, we're all, you know, maybe theoretically or intellectually aware that AI systems are built on data. I think we know that. You need huge amounts of data, but that makes it feel very clinical and detached. What is the data? Well, it's behavior. It's human creativity. If words are training ChatGPT, that's probably words that you and I may have written or spoken. So this isn't, you know, data isn't disconnected from the reality of like what who we are and what we make. And in many of these cases, this is, you know, driving data or voice data, you know, for Alexa or images for Instagram and so on. In the, you know, many of these data labelers were labeling snippets of text for ChatGPT as well. So this is all, you know, content generated by us and that somebody is sitting and labeling, because without that, AI systems just don't recognize what they are. You know, images need to be labeled, videos, you know, need to be analyzed. And there's somebody who has to do them. And you need, you know, this has to be done at a huge scale. So you need cheap labor, ultimately, to do it. And so people have turned to the developing world where, you know, you can pay a living wage, but that living wage is much more affordable than doing it in, you know, the West. And people want digital jobs because the jobs, the alternatives that they have are things like manual labor, cleaning, domestic work, construction work, and so on. So for me, you know, I wanted to firstly show, you know, what is the work and who are the people that are doing the work of building, you know, the bedrock of AI systems before we even get to training the systems and deploying them, right? But then also to figure out, you know, what does this labor market look like? And to try and, you know, I'm not an economist. So for me, again, it was a, from a journalistic viewpoint of like, how is this changing people's lives? Is it for the better or worse? Or what are the gray areas in between, right? And so I went to Bulgaria, I went to Nairobi and to Buenos Aires to look at three very different markets again, to see kind of what was the real impact on the lives of the, you know, low-income populations that had been recruited into this. And I think for me, the results were mixed and unexpected.
In what way?
Well, so I think, you know, the report, if you report on this from, you know, from a kind of news perspective, you know, of course, there's the question of are they being paid enough? And they're doing the same work, digital work that someone would do in the US or the UK. So why should they be paid any differently, right? And then, of course, there's the people running these companies say, oh, it would distort the local labor markets. You can't pay them too much. Because if they're living in the slums of Kibera in Nairobi, you can't suddenly be paying them more than everybody else. It would change all the local pricing, et cetera. I'm not sure that was true. You know, I think that there does need to be a complete sort of redefining of like, what do data laborers get paid? Because they are part of a pipeline of technology, which is worth billions, if not trillions of dollars coming out the other end. And one of the lawyers I spoke to in Kenya, who's fighting on behalf of some of these workers, you know, she kind of compared it to factory workers making Gucci shoes. You know, they might be in Bangladesh or the Philippines who have no idea that they're being what they're being paid is going into making a shoe that will ultimately be sold for $3,000 somewhere else. So I think that needs to be much more transparency of like, what does this technology ultimately cost? And how can people doing data work benefit from the upside of this huge opportunity, you know, in AI technology? But also, you know, on the flip side, I didn't think it was as easy as just saying we are, you know, these people in the developing world in Africa or in Asia or in Latin America need to be paid more and they're being paid $2 an hour and that's terrible. I think it did make a hugely positive difference to many lives. Like the people I spent time with in Nairobi and Sofia, you know, they were able to put their children through school, you know, pay for their parents' medical costs. Really, you know, their lives were different to when they were working in construction or unemployed or doing domestic work. And so there is something to be said that, you know, they can do these jobs flexibly and at home while learning digital skills and being part of this kind of new AI revolution. So that was, you know, like a bright spot for me. But I think I concluded that it's not enough to just give someone a job. It's not charity, right? They're working in exchange for money. We still need to push for, you know, making sure that they benefit from this, the AI kind of explosion that will come in business and industry. And currently, you know, their wages are hugely depressed when you look at how much money tech companies are making out the other end. So, yeah, I think that that's a problem to be solved.
We
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient, so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
That seemed to be, Madhu, one of the areas where you use kind of power as a way of trying to understand the whole situation and to reflect that, you know, whilst it's actually primarily poor people who are cleaning the data, poor communities that often are most shaped by AI applications at the moment, poor people that might have data proactively gathered on them, if they have more touch points with social services and other kind of public institutions. Whilst the models and the companies themselves obviously represent some of the greatest concentrations of wealth and power that we've ever seen. Was that something you saw more broadly, I guess, across the various reporting that you did and the places that you went?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was definitely an overall thread to the story, which was that, you know, when AI is developed, implemented, regulated, it's meant to be for the benefit of many, but often the people who see the benefits are those who are already advantaged or in a position of majority or in a position of privilege in society. And often the harms that we talk about with AI bias or the harms of using deepfakes against women on the internet, this is all experienced by minorities or kind of disadvantaged communities already. So that, you know, the inequities are just widening is what I was seeing over and over again. And while this happens, the entrenchment of power continues to scale up and increase, right? We've gone from social media companies having all of the data and kind of concentrating power in that way through their algorithms to, you know, maybe less than half a dozen AI companies that have the data, the infrastructure, and the know-how to build these technologies. They're the only people who really know how to test what's inside them, and really to kind of who control how they'll be implemented. And so I think I definitely saw that sort of widening inequity. I felt that the harms were seen, were primarily felt by not just like socioeconomically disadvantaged people, but in the case of, say, gig workers, it was often migrants, you know, who'd come to a new country and who didn't have really any option but to work as, say, an Uber driver or a delivery, you know, food delivery courier. So it was often these people who are being harmed by AI systems.
Well, was there anywhere that you found where it kind of struck you more that, oh my gosh, AI really is improving lives and the risks are being managed in ways which really lean us towards being more optimistic? I mean, healthcare, like med tech, was that an area where you thought like maybe, you know, it's quite clear that the positives are outweighing the negatives at the moment?
Yeah, I think for me, like the spots of optimism are scientific innovation and healthcare, two areas where it just, you know, this technology is ripe for innovation in. I think, you know, I haven't written very much in this book about scientific innovation, but I, you know, in a former life was studying to be an immunologist. And so I'm really interested in the kind of crossover between health technology and kind of pushing forward the frontiers of science. And there are some really amazing examples we've seen with AlphaFold, for example, that has come out of Google's AI arm DeepMind, which is based in London, a system that can predict the structure of proteins, which any protein in the world, which helps then to kind of develop new materials, whether that's in pharmaceuticals or energy and so on, which I think is kind of really exciting. And healthcare in particular, I write about in my book, specifically the story of a doctor in India, an Indian doctor who works in a very rural part of Western India, just on the border, you know, out a few hours from Mumbai. And she mostly works with local tribal populations, and she's helping to train an AI system that can help diagnose tuberculosis. For me, this was just fascinating because, you know, it's a really kind of widespread illness, but it's a treatable and a curable one. Yet people are dying from it because of lack of access. So there it just feels really kind of a no-brainer, right? If you can train an AI system that can go out into the kind of innards of the country in mobile vans without doctors to screen people, you know, the downsides are pretty low. Either it's going to tell you you might have it and you don't, but yet at least you're being seen to, or it tells you you don't have it, but in many cases you wouldn't have known anyway. And it's just, you know, it's a way to kind of bring medical expertise to so many people who currently just have nothing. And I think that there are really promising scientific results to show that AI systems are really good at being able to analyze scans for kind of various cancers and other illnesses, including COVID. And if we can implement that in you know, a structured way across our healthcare systems here in the NHS, we're struggling with a huge lack of radiologists. Anyone who's kind of had to live within this, our healthcare system, can see how it's creaking at the edges. You know, this, I think this can, it's more than a band-aid. I think it can really kind of change how we receive care. So for me, that's a huge opportunity.
Do you think that the medical profession has wider lessons that maybe other industries should learn? I'm just reflecting that maybe in addition to the kind of technical promise that AI has, it's also in medicine, like landing in a context which has a lot more kind of institutional bounding around it. You know, like it's really clear how like clinical data should be used and like the privacy of patients is really well defined, and like the responsibilities of a doctor to the patient are also well defined. And it just feels like there's a lot more guardrails that will shape AI use in medicine than, for instance, like predictive policing, where it just feels like it's a completely open kind of like, you know, landscape where, it, you know, and in that openness where there aren't really any clear understandings, it's there we'll see the overreach, we'll see the, you know, the misaligned incentives, and we'll see kind of good intentions being kind of swamped by the messiness of application.
Yeah, no, I think that you're right. It's there is the expectation of patient privacy and the protection of data and things in healthcare, which could be really good lessons. But also it's the human side of it, right? We all understand instinctively, you know, why we value human doctors. Of course, it's because they can diagnose us and tell us how to get better. But it's also, you know, having a person who can break news to you that's really difficult, or helping you cope with something that, you know, even, you know, positive health news like pregnancy. I remember like having a really weird interaction with a GP when I first found out I was pregnant. It was a lovely, happy thing, but the sort of delivery and the interaction left me feeling really cold. So I think we all inherently understand why we value humans in the medical process. And I think one of the things that Ashita Singh, who's the doctor that I write about, said, which I think is really kind of applicable beyond, is she never saw this in any way as a threat to her or a replacement for her, because, you know, she knows her value as a doctor in this community and what she can do. But she saw it as one of the many tools in her toolkit, you know, alongside x-rays or CT scans or whatever else. You know, this was another great tool to help kind of give her confidence, or to give less experienced doctors more confidence in the news they were delivering, and to kind of increase access to care. And I think that's how anyone implementing these systems should see it, as, you know, we can never replace the expertise of humans that we've built up, whether that's social workers who kind of understand the communities they've been embedded in, or criminal justice, defense lawyers, or whatever it is in any area of kind of human expertise. We need to kind of, you know, those up that we need to preserve that alongside these systems and allow them to kind of enhance what you do and bring that to more people, rather than thinking of it as a way to just kind of cut costs or replace. Mm. I think healthcare is a way for us to understand why humans matter.
Well, zooming out in the last 10 minutes that we have to try and extract some of the overarching themes, let's talk about big tech. So one thing I was really struck by in all your stories is the seeming like absence of public sector AI capability. Like, there doesn't seem to be barely a government in the world that can train or deploy like models. And so is that changing the role of the AI companies in public life? It seems like they're all over the world in thousands of different ways, like creeping closer and closer to government, and more intimately interwoven into the business of the state.
Absolutely. And I think for me, the structure of the book was also done to reflect this, where they're a specter that comes in across the book. They kind of appear in these unexpected places.
You're like,
right?
Oh, yeah, what's Microsoft doing there?
What are they up to in Salta? Or, you know, I didn't realize Uber was doing this or whatever, you know? So I think that was the point, to say we might not realize it, but they're getting closer and closer to providing, you know, the basic infrastructure to government. So I spoke to a Mexican data activist, Paula Ricaurte. She's a political scientist, activist. And she was talking about how during COVID, you know, the Mexican government was reliant on Google for their own data collection of what was happening in the country during the pandemic, because, you know, the infrastructure was provided by the company and they couldn't kind of develop anything without them. Similarly, you have, you know, AWS and Azure and Google as well in India providing much of the healthcare infrastructure. Again, I spoke to, social, not just activists, but kind of researchers looking at the relationships between companies and governments, who said, it's so deeply embedded that we don't think our governments could provide much of the services they're doing without these companies anymore. And I think we've all become increasingly aware of how reliant we are, even personally, on these systems for interpersonal communication, for the work that we do, you know, in our relationship with our state. And this was why, the stories reflect that increasing scale. This is about power. And I think big tech is becoming increasingly sort of playing the role of what we would usually look to the state for. I mentioned before about them having all of the knowledge and resources required to build future AI systems as well, which also puts them in a position, you know, just in terms of the knowledge that they have, where governments are going to be reliant on them to provide this stuff. I wrote years ago now, in 2019, about how increasingly we were seeing less academics, independent academics at universities working on AI problems, particularly, I don't mean AI ethics problems or social impact of AI, I mean actual AI development. You know, academics who are funded to build these systems and understand how they work and try and break them. And now, here we are, you know, 5 years later, that problem has only increased. Meredith Whittaker, who's the president of Signal and has written a lot about this, you know, the concentration of power, where we see now that you really can't be an independent academic funded by public grants and have the infrastructure you need to build a large language model. So many, many academics we see now do these dual roles where they work part-time for companies, part-time. And it's good because, you know, you're learning from the companies, you're spreading this back out into universities. But I do think it says something about the direction of, you know, who's going to hold these, you know, never mind the companies and the regulatory angle, but even just the systems to account. Where is the accountability if nobody understands how they work outside of people inside, you know, profit-making institutions? And then we come to regulation. So yes, I do think that we're seeing the companies really kind of almost quasi-states at this point. Many of them have more data, money, and power than many states do.
And let's talk about data. So as states, as companies become increasingly like states or step in to supply services, AI services to states, is there a kind of grand swap happening? Because it seems as they move their AI capabilities into public services around the world, the big thing that states have is data on citizens, kinds of data that the AI companies, as basically ads and platform providers, could never have dreamed of before, especially health data, but civic data. Is that the great swap that's currently happening? Are public sector authorities around the world basically swapping that data on citizens to power, like necessarily to power the models and the training which is needed in order to actually deploy AI in the ways that they want?
So I think that, you know, it is going to be very difficult for any company or government, like independently, at least in the West. I think China is different. They hold huge amount of data that, you know, that is crossed up and connected both on local and global levels. And they also, you know, they can build their own technology, state-owned technology as well. But if we are going to procure AI systems as a, you know, in Western governments, of course, you're going to have to find somebody to do that for you. And we've seen that, you know, with the NHS, there have been many attempts over the years to kind of use that data in a way that can help people. At the moment, you know, Palantir has won a big contract here in the UK. This is the American data company that works a lot for defense departments around the world, was initially funded by a CIA grant. You know, they work in those areas and they are now powering much of the infrastructure for the NHS's kind of data. So we are seeing, you know, through channels of procurement, tech companies come in. But I do think that, you know, the work of the next few years is figuring out how can governments benefit from that expertise and help citizens while also protecting this, as you say, very valuable data that, you know, in a way that can actually, you know, that we can all see some benefit in them. I don't feel hopeless about this. You know, yes, we will have these five big tech companies, cloud companies involved in many ways because they're forming the infrastructure and backbone of AI now or of the internet. But I think there are ways to kind of keep our data safe, and that will be the work that governments will have to do moving forward.
Well, final question, Madhu. Tell us a story about Counterpower, because we haven't really spoken much about that, but all these other people aren't passive recipients of all this, are they? And the book's full of the inspiring, fascinating kind of examples of people, both with tech and without, kind of finding ways of you know, reclaiming autonomy and independence and collective action. So let's end with one of those.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you say that. So I actually wanted it. So the final three chapters are actually around this theme of resistance in small and big ways. You know, the gig workers and how they fight back, you know, by kind of these little tricks that help them to kind of compete against the algorithm and twist it so that they can kind of get the best jobs, which, you know, which are like wonderful and inspiring. But kind of on the highest level, I spent time with Maya Wang, who is a Chinese activist. She works for Human Rights Watch, but she's had to leave Hong Kong where she was based and is now in the US. And she was one of the, or she was the woman who uncovered the data system, the algorithmic system that underpinned the policing in the Xinjiang state in China. So, you know, Xinjiang, a region in China where the you have a high concentration of Uyghur Muslims, and it's been reported widely now around the world that there are these education or re-education camps, as the Chinese government calls them, where, you know, many Uyghur Muslims who are trapped in a sort of dragnet of surveillance are put into to sort of teach them to be Chinese, to teach them the language. Many cases, you know, people in these camps have disappeared, and, you know, they've been called out as, you know, huge human rights issue. And Maya was able to find the app that was being used by the police in the Xinjiang state. She found it, you know, by trawling the internet and like essentially decoding what exactly they were surveilling, you know, what are the various variables that they're tracking about all of these families. Many cases, they haven't done anything. They're just talking to relatives in other countries and so on, and finding a way to kind of trap them in this dragnet. And she, you know, is really genuinely risking her life to expose how this ecosystem works, to kind of decode this. And, you know, for her, it's the work that she feels compelled to do, which, you know, and we talked, you know, we've met quite a few times and talked about, does she feel she's actually making a difference against this huge, powerful institution, which is the CCP? And is it worth it? And, you know, she said, you know, she does question this herself on many days. But for her, she feels that, like, it feels like it's just her, but it never has been. Whenever you have oppression and surveillance and curtailment of human rights, you might think you're on your own, but there's actually, you know, a whole boatload of people rowing in the same direction. And so that for me was kind of the most inspiring takeaway of this whole thing, that there are automated systems that are curtailing our individual agency and kind of increasing opacity of how things operate in the world around us. But we can have a voice in it, and, you know, that's what we should be doing over the next few years, finding our voices.
Well, Madhu, thank you. This has been totally fascinating. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. We haven't been alone either. So thanks for tuning in. The book, again, is Code Dependent, Living in the Shadow of AI, and it's available from your local bookshop. I'm Carl Miller, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Isabella Soames and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. Members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.